We're seeing power shifts at the United Nations.
You have the rise of corporate economic power really challenging national governmental economic power.
Plus, Russian adoptions and lobbying to follow Oprah and Michelle Obama. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. The balance of global power is in transition. CNN host Fareed Zakaria has been praised and panned for his book that discusses the global power picture of a post-American world. But the fact is that there are rising powers and indications that the U.S. days of wielding the big stick may be waning. Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. And she's authored several books on the UN and global issues.
Certainly the claim that the U.S. has on UN decision-making because of the financing of the UN is important. The U.S. has such a so much larger economy than any other country in the world that it is, of course, pays more dues at the UN and is the largest contributor to many special funds and projects and that sort of thing. Given that, it gives the U.S. significant additional power, although it's not supposed to be that way, in decision-making. Other countries are often afraid to challenge the U.S. Because they're afraid it won't sponsor or pay for favored or important U.N. projects, and most particularly because so many countries in the developing world, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, in the Middle East, are dependent on U.S. support of various kinds, that even in, say, the General Assembly, where there is no veto by the U.S., the fear of a backlash, a bilateral backlash from Washington, is enough to make a sort of functional veto be put in place, where the U.S. can simply tell other countries, look, if you vote X way, the way we don't want you to vote, there will be a price to pay. There's a famous precedent for that at the UN. It's known as the Yemen precedent, ironically, given the significance of Yemen today. But it actually emerged back in 1990 when George Bush I was trying to garner a unanimous Security Council decision to endorse his plan to go to war against Iraq back in the first Gulf War. And on the Council, there were numerous bribes and threats and punishments that were used. I document a good deal of that in that book. But two countries voted no. One was Cuba, that voted no on principle against intervention. And the other was Yemen, the only Arab country on the Council, had recently been reunified after a brutal civil war that had lasted more than 10 years. And no sooner had the Yemeni ambassador put down his hand than the U.S. ambassador was at his side and said to him, that will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast. And there was a big scandal about it because the remark was picked up on an open mic. 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen, which was then and remains the poorest country in the Arab world. So there was a huge price to be paid, and the U.S. made sure that the rest of the world knew it. That kind of pressure continues. The difference is that the sole superpower, as it were, of 1990 with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War that left the U.S. so enormously powerful around the world has now been changing so that you have multiple power centers in a variety of parts of the world. You have rising economic powers in places like certainly China, but also in Brazil, in South Africa, in other countries, you have rising military powers challenging the U.S., and crucially, you have rising political forces, ranging from the European Union to China to Iran and others who don't necessarily see the U.S. as the sole decision-maker at the U.N. So things are changing, but the U.S. remains by far the most powerful single country in that institution.
What kind of impact has the global economy had on those power struggles?
Well, that's been crucial because as you see the impact of the global economic collapse someplace like in the U.S., where for the first time in two generations, really since the Great Depression, the U.S. has had to confront the reality that it is not an invincible economic power with the economic clout to do whatever it wants around the world, buy whatever it wants, bribe whatever governments it wants, buy whatever governments it wants. Those things are simply not available at this point. At the same time, you have rising countries, Brazil being a great example, India being another, China being another, where the global economic crisis did not pass them by entirely, but because they were already on the rise, they were not powers already at their peak, as it were, they were impacted far less. So they have remained rising powers that are able to challenge the power of the U.S. You also have, and this is perhaps even more important, the globalization of the economy in the sense that what happens in a country matters far less than it used to in terms of what corporations do and what how power gets distributed. So if you look, for example, at the role of corporations in the United Nations, of course, it has been on the rise for 20 years. Partnerships with the, quote, private sector have become an important part of how UN projects are funded. And you have a scenario, if you look, for example, at the auto industry in the United States, in the early days of the auto industry, and really up until about the 1970s, you had a situation where the auto manufacturers had every interest in paying good wages, helping to create a middle class who could then buy their products. In the current situation, they don't really care whether there's a middle class able to buy their products or not. They can afford to keep wages incredibly low, strip the unions of their power, because their markets are all over the world. So in that situation, you have the rise of corporate economic power really challenging national governmental economic power, and you see that at the UN as much as you do anywhere else.
So as you watch these trends, what do you predict is the future in the next 10, 20 years? Fareed Zakaria tried to write a book saying that, you know, the U.S. may not be the center of the universe and was widely given a lot of trouble for it simply because people didn't want to hear it.
Well, I think that's certainly going to be true. I think that's only the beginning, however. I think what happens and how that plays out in the rest of the world is going to be very dependent on what we do in this country, the kinds of movements that we build to reclaim power for people in this country and to strip the corporations of power. There is an ongoing battle for how economic power gets translated into political power, and it's going to be up to us to build movements that can overturn that decision, for example, at the Supreme Court, overturn the Citizens United decision, make it politically impossible for a continuation of the current policies of waging wars while lowering taxes. The five biggest corporations that build bombers and bombs and bullets and all those things, they have earned, since 2002, a 450% rise in their profits. 450%. And they're taxed at functionally zero. Their tax rates are whatever they are. They're 25-30%, but they almost, to a corporation, they pay virtually nothing because of all the loopholes. That, to me, is criminal. And this is something that, for example, FDR, back in 1940, called for a special tax to be imposed. This is at the beginning of World War II, where he said, we should make sure that the few do not profit from the sacrifices of the many. That's precisely what we have today. The few, the 1%, if you will, the CEOs of major corporations, and particularly these giant war corporations, are making a killing, in both senses of the word, on the continuation of these wars that are unpopular in the U.S., that do not have public support, and yet they're not paying any kind of a war profiteering tax. An excess profits tax was the more polite term that FDR used, but essentially it means the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of work to do. This isn't something we can just sort of stand back and watch and say, I wonder what's going to happen this year. We have to reclaim the ability to make history ourselves.
Phyllis, just for argument's sake, if all of those things happened in this country, corporations are no longer U.S. corporations, they're global corporations. Even if the U.S. makes a change, will it have a significant impact on the direction the future's taking?
Absolutely, because corporations, the biggest corporations, are still chartered here. And while they operate all around the world, most notably in offshore tax havens, they certainly don't plan to pick up and move there. They don't want to live there. They want to live in New York, where they have all the advantages of all the cultural and educational advances and travel and all those things. We hear these threats, well, we can't raise the taxes on corporations because they'll leave, because the U.S. already has the highest corporate tax rates in the world, is mostly simply not true. On paper, it's partly true. But in reality, it's quite the opposite. The actual taxes that these corporations pay is among the lowest in the world. And they know that. So there's no, this is not what we have to worry about. What we have to worry about is the power that these corporate leaders have to strip wages, to strip the power of unions, to undermine what corporations once helped to create, which was a middle class in this country. That no longer is the case.
Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington and is a fellow at the Transnational Institute in the Netherlands. She's authored several books on the UN and global issues. Coming up, a very personal view of the Russian ban on American adoptions, and a mom whose goal is to be the commencement speaker at her daughter's graduation. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1229. When the Russian government announced its ban on American adoptions of Russian children at the beginning of the year, it set off protests in Moscow and a huge outcry in the States. The ban is seen as a political move, and writer Tina Traster, the author of a book about her own experience adopting a Russian child, said it's a huge mistake that hurts the children as well as parents hoping to adopt.
I have seen many grim things in my lifetime. Few rival the sights, sounds, and smells I experienced in the Siberian orphanage where my daughter's life began 10 years ago. Julia lived in a gray concrete complex, not far from a side street where my husband and I saw a man selling meat from a dead carcass in minus 20 degree Fahrenheit temperature, and where another man lay on his side, bloated, red-faced, and stoned on vodka. There was a rusted jungle gym poking out from dirt-crusted snow outside the cheerless building. Our baby, then 7 months, spent her days inside a frozen fortress, which reeked of ammonia. Rather than being fed enough formula, she was nursed on a sugary tea that would later rot her baby teeth with caries. She slept on a tiny cot in a room full of orphans, some of whom would have a real home one day, and others who wouldn't. We've been told our daughter, abandoned by a 20-year-old mother who could not care for her, spent her first 12 weeks in a hospital with respiratory infections and dysentery during the Russian summer of 2002. She was brought to baby house number 2 in mid-September when it was already too cold to take babies outside. My infant daughter had never squinted into the sun or felt the wind against her skin. When we met her on our first trip to Novosibirsk, we spent a half hour in a cavernous gym trying to play on rubber mats. In the gym, she showed no interest in a large rubber ball we rolled toward her. She had no concept of play. Instead, she laid on the mat, arching her back over and over and over. I was scared. Olga, our handler, told us infants don't get enough exercise. Their little bodies ache so that they stretch their muscles. I saw what Olga meant when a caretaker placed my baby in a cot and swaddled her so tightly she wouldn't fuss. Couldn't fuss. It was brutal to leave Julia behind on the first trip, but we had no choice because Russia required a second trip to complete the adoption. After leaving her in a cot, I glanced over to a little boy whose eyes were set wide apart and whose expression was blank. Olga later told me children like that, children with fetal alcohol syndrome, will spend the rest of their lives in an orphanage. I left baby house number 2 crying for Julia and for that little boy and for every child who is doomed to life in an orphanage. A decade later, I weep again as I try to absorb the shocking news that Russia is banning American parents from adopting their orphans. These children were victims of circumstance. Now they are political pawns. The newly passed law is Russia's retaliation against the U.S. Magnitsky Act, which was signed into law by President Obama in December. The act introduces sanctions against Russian officials suspected of human rights abuses. In rationalizing its action, Russian officials say Americans too have violated human rights. They are referring to the death of 19 Russian children at the hands of their adoptive parents over the last 2 decades, the light sentences they've received, and to the horrendous incident of a Tennessee mother who put her 7-year-old adoptive son on a plane to Moscow alone to return him. In these cases of neglect and death, adoptive parents found themselves with children who were suffering from extreme attachment disorders and violent behavioral problems. Many of the children were said to be unmanageable, inconsolable, and in many cases dangerous to themselves and others. I am not condoning or excusing those parents, but these shameful acts deserve context. Of the 60,000 Russian adoptees who've been placed in American homes in the last 2 decades, the number in which circumstances turned extreme is minuscule. So many of the Russian children arrived with deep, dark issues, my own child included. In truth, we are not prepared to parent such hurt children, but it becomes our life's work. Russian officials say 650,000 children are living in orphanages. Mental health experts agree children who start their lives in orphanages are likely to suffer from lack of care and nurture. Baby house number 2 had 100 children. A baby needs the nurture of one mother, one caretaker. Shutting down American adoption is a hardship for American parents waiting and wanting to adopt. More importantly, it is a human rights abuse on the tiniest of victims. Babies who would otherwise find a passage to a better life will languish in orphanages longer. Though Russian officials say they'll adopt to other countries and foster their children, everyone knows the wheels of bureaucracy grind slowly. To date, adoption of one Russian child to an American family typically takes 18 months. Why lengthen a baby's prison sentence in an orphanage? It breaks my heart to picture those children who are left behind. I have seen their faces. I wish every member of the Russian parliament had been forced to spend 2 hours in an orphanage before casting their callous votes. In the meantime, what can our diplomats or leaders do urgently to reverse this nightmare? I don't know. I'm not a politician. I'm only an adoptive parent who has seen what the inside of a Siberian orphanage looks like.
Tina Traster is the author of an upcoming memoir about her relationship with her Russian adopted daughter. Find out more at juliaandme.com. And finally, I would like to introduce you to Sumaya Hodges of Las Vegas, Nevada. She's the owner of a beauty salon and the proud mom of a college student. She's got a dream. She wants to be the commencement speaker at her daughter's graduation, and she wants your help.
Sumaya Takes Flight is a campaign about me wanting to be the commencement speaker for Spelman University. My daughter, Lamaya Hodges, she's a student over at Spelman, and she graduates May of 2013. Last year, my daughter said to me, she said, Mom, 2 years ago, Michelle Obama spoke for the commencement ceremony. And last year, it was Oprah Winfrey. She said, now, how could they top those two women for my graduation? And that's when I said, your mom. So ever since then, I have been on this quest to try to make it happen.
Okay, first of all, what was your daughter's reaction to that?
My daughter knows that whatever I put my mind to do it, I'm going to do it. So she knew I was serious when I said that. And she was like, yeah, you can do it, because she said, Mom, all of the speakers that have came to our school, I sit there and listen to them, and I promise you, it's everything that you have ever said and everything that you have ever told me. If they can do it, you can do it.
All right, so explain why you think you should be that commencement speaker.
First of all, I feel like they do need a common mom. The second, because my daughter would be the first one to graduate from six generations in my family. And I want to talk about parental involvement. The reason why that I believe no one else went to college or graduated from college is because the parents were not involved in their child's education. So I'm trying to break that cycle in my family with my daughter. So from day one, from kindergarten, I have been in her life as far as helping her, you know, with her homework and just education, just being there for her. And she has proved my theory.
So what is your story, Sumaya? Where did you come from, and what have you done with your life that you've managed to turn out a terrific daughter who's going to graduate college?
Oh, well, I was born out of seven children, the third to the oldest out of seven. And so my mom did an awesome thing for me going to school. When I was in the 11th grade, I got accepted in a cosmetology program at West County Tech. Now, West County Tech and the cosmetology program, that was free because it was like high school, so it was free. The only thing that we had to pay for was this kit, and it had my tools in it, my blow dryer, curling irons, and so on. That kit cost $285. Well, my mom had seven kids on welfare, and that was her whole welfare check, the amount that they needed. My mom made a huge sacrifice and gave me that check. And so ever since then, I've just been so grateful, and I'm just trying to strive so hard to make it so that I can repay her and to help her. So right now, I am the owner of Granny's Beauty Center. I'm an internationally known hairstylist, a radio personality for Granny Cares. And by the way, everything is Granny's. My beauty salon is Granny's Beauty Center. That's my mom. That was her nickname. So when she passed away, I wanted to leave a legacy, so I'm doing everything in Granny's name. So we have Granny's Beauty Center. We have Granny Cares, the radio station. And I just published a book, Granny Said. Granny said that if you can't find a job, create a job. So my whole inner being is just trying to inspire and motivate others to be more than what they are right now, and that you can do it.
And what will you tell those graduates? What would your message be?
My message basically is just never give up. Even if you get out of school, because there's so many college graduates who still can't find a job. So even once you get out of school, just never give up. I don't care what the odds are, what the circumstances, just keep on striving for higher heights. But when you start having your family and stuff to play that role in your child's life, and also to reach back to another child, a friend, a neighbor, a stranger, just reach back and help someone else along the way. I've never been a quitter. I challenge myself, and that's the message I just want everybody to do. Challenge. Just get out and just challenge yourself. Make it happen. You can do this.
If people want to help you do this, what can they do to help you?
They can go to YouTube and type in Sumaya Takes Flight, give it thumbs up, and just spread the word with everybody else. Just, you know, let them know to share this. This is a common mom. She wants to speak at her daughter's graduation. Please go to YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, and just spread the word.
Sumaya Hodges has started Sumaya Takes Flight on Facebook and Twitter in an effort to be selected as commencement speaker when her daughter graduates from Spelman University. That's Sumaya Takes Flight. And good luck, Sumaya. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.